This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. The UN says there's no sign. The warring parties in Sudan are ready to seriously negotiate as a ceasefire between the two sides remains fragile. A British charity says over a million children received food aid in the past 12 months as the country faces an unprecedented cost of living crisis. And also in our headlines, as Jerome Hughes reports, EU lawmakers are raising concern about energy shortages in the bloc amid the absence of sufficient planning for next winter. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the United Nations Special Envoy for Sudan says the rival military factions are not ready to seriously negotiate to help end the deadly war, deadly power struggle in the African country.
The two generals continue trading accusations and issuing competing claims of control over key installations. There is yet no unequivocal sign that either is ready to seriously negotiate, suggesting that both think that securing a military victory over the other is possible.
Volker Perthes further said that top generals in control of Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces suffer from miscalculation. Perthes also warned about prolonged conflict, saying the fighting would further break down law and order throughout the country. He underlined that Sudan's potential fragmentation could have a devastating blow to the region. The UN envoy made the remarks while briefing the Security Council on Tuesday. In the meeting, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reiterated his call for an immediate cessation of hostility in Sudan.
Excellencies, the fighting must stop immediately. We need an all-out effort for peace. I call on the parties to the conflict, on Generals Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, Emeti, and the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces to silence the guns. It is incumbent on Sudanese leaders to put the interests of their people front and center. This conflict will not and must not be resolved on the battlefield with the bodies of Sudan's people.
The fighting in Sudan broke out on April 15th. The Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces paramilitary group fight to have a say in the future politics of the African country, according to the UN's health agency. The clashes left more than 400 dead. Several temporary ceasefires have been announced to allow evacuations of citizens and civilians and foreign citizens. The latest truce was announced on Monday. For 3 days, the UN says it seems to be holding in some parts so far. However, there have been reports of fighting and movement of troops. The army and the paramilitary group have both accused one another of violating the ceasefire.
Fighting persists in Sudan despite several ceasefire agreements between the army and the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces or RSF. The deadly conflict, which has so far claimed hundreds of lives and displaced many others, has brought much of the country's vital infrastructure to a standstill. Water and power have been cut and hospitals are damaged and closed. People find it almost impossible to provide their basic necessities. Weary residents must stand in line for bread in neighborhoods largely emptied of civilian life. Many are trapped or stranded in their homes, risking theft and looting if they venture out.
It hasn't. We can't sleep. We haven't slept in the past 4 days. We try to catch a few naps here and there, but it's not helping at all. We haven't left our house.
In the suburbs of three main cities of Khartoum, Bahri, and Omdurman, where are scenes of heavy clashes, people lock suitcases long distances by foot towards bus stops as they try to flee those areas and seek refuge in countries like Chad and South Sudan. According to UN estimates, some 2,000 Sudanese have so far arrived in South Sudan, most of them women and children. Non-stop airstrikes, shelling, and gun battles have ripped across the city day and night. The RSF says it has embedded itself in several neighborhoods, taking over buildings and other residential places. The army, on the other side, has used airstrikes and heavy artillery to try to force its rivals back. Army officials said they are trying to clear what they call hotbeds of rebel groups from the capital, Khartoum. Heavy gunfire and deadly airstrikes have prompted so many countries to withdraw their citizens and nationals from the Northeast African nation. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, France, Turkey, the Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, the UK, the US, and so many other countries have already evacuated their citizens or have deployed soldiers and provided flights to secure their return. Some other nations, including Canada, have suspended their operations in Sudan amid heavy fighting there.
The conflict in Sudan has raised fears that the growing tensions might develop into a bigger crisis. That's against the backdrop of a seemingly endless power struggle in Sudan and the mass flight of refugees amid the deadly conflict.
The decision by many of world countries to evacuate their citizens from Sudan comes more than a week after clashes broke out between rival forces, the army led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the RSF commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hemeti. The cause of the conflict? Tensions over the planned integration of RSF into Sudan's regular army. Many around the globe have warned that the conflict could plunge the country into a deeper chaos. This comes to the spotlight, especially when outside forces are further complicating the situation by providing arms or other military and financial assistance to either of the warring sides there. But what help would withdrawing foreign nationals from Sudan provide? Many argue that with foreign countries evacuating their diplomatic staff, it will be easier to put pressure on armed rivals to agree to a longer and more effective ceasefire. That, however, raises questions as to whether the conflict, which is merely an existential power struggle on both sides, as many put it, will ever come to an end. Observers believe it is very unlikely that the two military commanders will ever come to the negotiating table and resolve differences. With that possibility being in the sight, there are national and international ramifications regarding the conflict. On the international level, one major consequence would be the exodus of refugees all moving toward the borders of Europe. That will eventually create a huge burden for the European countries, which are already grappling with the fallout of the US wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, or Libya and many other countries for that matter, with influx of migrants seeking refuge there. Maybe that's why world countries, especially those in Europe and Sudan's neighbors, must join hand in hand to bring this deadly conflict to an end. At home, the longer they battle it out in city streets, the higher the civilian toll will climb and the harder it will be for either general to rule over the wreckage. If not, it can be expected that a major tragedy will be just around the corner. What seems to be of high urgency for Sudan is that this country, which has been the hotbed of back-to-back military coups, has to be ruled by a civilian-led democracy, something that the Sudanese people have long been calling for and for which they have paid a heavy price.
More than a million children in the UK have received food aid in the past 12 months, as the country battles a cost-of-living crisis. Latest figures show 300,000 kids have been added to the list of food aid recipients compared with the previous year. Reports say food banks have become a feature of life as the cost of living has gone up and wages remain the same. The cost-of-living crisis in Britain has seen sectors across the economy, such as doctors, nurses, and teachers, go on strike in the past year. The UK grapples with the biggest surge in prices in decades. Fuel, heating, and food and housing costs are all soaring. Uncertainty grows around vital energy supply and storage capacity for the European Union. Lawmakers are forecasting catastrophe in the absence of sufficient planning for the winter of 2023. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU's industry and economy was built thanks to decades of cheap gas supply from Russia. Now the bloc has shut that supply off due to the war in Ukraine. A mild winter ensured reasonable energy storage was maintained in the EU, and prices, while very high, did not bring the bloc to breaking point. The US has made a fortune by exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas, to the 27-nation bloc. Lawmakers warn there could be greater competition for LNG in 2023.
If China were to return to 2021 LNG consumption levels, the EU could end up with a gap between demand and supply of 27 billion cubic meters, which is no small amount. Citizens need to be reassured. We can't just pray for another mild winter.
There have been calls during a European Parliament debate for the EU to urgently up its game regarding energy storage technology.
The EU has only a limited amount of storage capacity, with the majority of energy being stored in the form of pumped hydro, which has significant geographical limitations.
Experts warn that energy shortages in the coming months could push EU inflation through the roof. The bloc's leaders are looking towards Africa and the Middle East for supply, but that's a costly exercise.
The problem is that European leadership is not leading Europe to a better future. The problem is that they are servants of American lobby, and they're providing exclusively the interests of Americans.
Iran could solve the EU's energy needs, but the bloc is following the United States down the path of sanctions. Legislators are also critical of moves being made domestically.
Germany has just closed its last nuclear reactor. That is a catastrophe. Germany is risking increasing prices. It's a huge mistake.
Given the dire implications associated with a potential energy crisis, many lawmakers here are calling on those who shape EU foreign policy to put the interests of citizens ahead of demands emanating from Washington. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
European defence spending has reached levels not seen since the end of the Cold War, according to a new report. Many say the military buildup and the flooding of arms into Ukraine may end the EU's claim to be a project of peace. Rami Mazouri reports in Paris.
A new report on global military spending found that the European Union's expenditures soared 13% last year to reach $345 billion. That means the bloc is the world's second largest arms purchaser, sprinting far ahead of China, but spending well less than half of the United States. European military spending has now reached its highest level since the end of the Cold War 30 years ago. The historic increase in European military spending comes despite once-in-a-generation inflation records, as their sanctions campaign against Russia keeps backfiring against the Western economy.
It's quite shocking. Today in France, there has been months of social tension over our pension system, and due to an alleged deficit of 15 billion euros, while the five-year spending plan for the French army calls for over 450 billion euros. France is just one component of the European equation, but it's clear only the arms industry is happy about this increase in military spending.
Brussels has repeatedly ramped up the conflict in Ukraine with once unthinkable arms deliveries. European arms are already all over Africa and the Middle East due to Western support for failed interventions in places like Libya, Syria, across the Sahel, and elsewhere. Last year, Finland, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia recorded the biggest increases in military spending. Globally, defense expenditures increased 4% this year to a record $2.24 trillion. That only barely exceeds the $1.98 trillion budgeted this year for the United States Department of Defense. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A high-ranking Iranian economic delegation arrived in Damascus. Meetings were being held between the officials of the two countries, focusing on further developing economic ties to reach the level of their strategic political relations. Our correspondent in Damascus has the details in this report.
Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking economic delegation. He met with Syria's Minister of Economy and discussed economic cooperation, in which the two sides set new work mechanisms in the financial and economic fields. They underlined the necessity of removing obstacles for better economic and trade relations. The Joint Syrian-Iranian Economic Committee also convened. The talks covered boosting collaboration in the economic, investment, agricultural, industrial, trade, transport, and religious tourism sectors. The members underlined the importance of canceling custom tariffs and taxes, as well as expanding activities in the banking sector by using local currencies to counter Western sanctions imposed on both states.
We agreed on focusing cooperation in the electricity sector. Syrians are in dire need of electricity due to power shortages. We have lots of experience and capabilities in establishing and repairing damaged electricity stations. We will assist Syria soon in generating electric power. Meanwhile, we agreed on increasing flights to Syria to 50,000 Iranian visitors annually. We also want to establish a direct railway route from Iran to Syria.
A Syrian-Iranian work forum was also held. The officials met with businessmen in the private sector and listened to their concerns. They promised to facilitate their work with the aim of encouraging joint partnerships and increasing the bulk of trade exchange between Syria and Iran.
At post-war times, countries like Syria suffer from economic hardships. Iran, as a long-time ally of Syria, is assisting the Arab country to emerge from its economic woes and overcome Western sanctions through establishing partnerships that benefit both countries. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Iran's foreign minister has described the presence of foreign forces in the West Asia region as, quote, costly and disruptive. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, in Muscat. He said inclusive security is an indispensable necessity for the region. Amir Abdullahian also stressed the need for further strengthening of cooperation among regional states. Iran's top diplomat arrived in the Omani capital on Tuesday at the invitation of his counterpart for high-level talks. Amir Abdullahian is accompanied by a high-ranking political delegation. He's scheduled to visit Lebanon on Wednesday. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee, with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Leader meets with senior armed forces commanders and officials. On Sunday, 16th of April 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with a group of top military commanders and security officials in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Meeting with a group of top military commanders in Tehran on Sunday afternoon, 16th of April, and on the eve of Army Day in the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the commander-in-chief of the Iranian Armed Forces, met with senior commanders and personnel of the armed forces. Sitting in a semicircle pattern around the leader in a very informal atmosphere, Brigadier General Bagheri, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, presented a report on the plans and steps taken by the armed forces in various areas. After Brigadier General Bagheri's presentation, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction about the performance of Iran's armed forces, addressing the gathering by recounting a hadith or narration from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. In Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, says, "By God's permission, the military is the strong walls protecting the country and the nation." The leader went on to stress that with this lofty status comes heavy responsibilities. He added that, thank God, members of the armed forces appreciate this unique and elite status and are engaged in activities based on their responsibilities. Expressing his satisfaction with the continued progress of the armed forces, he advised them not to be content with any level of progress and to press ahead, advancing forward always, without ever stopping. The leader pointedly added, "Appreciate your own worth, the very important job that you do, and the heavy responsibilities that go with it." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah said that Khamenei stressed that as long as threats exist in all areas relating to the armed forces, such as the Air Force, ground forces, the Navy, intelligence and counterintelligence operations, etc., they must be ready and alert. He pointedly added, "Threats are always with us. We can assume at times that peace has been established and we are not in a state of war. But we can never assume that threats have disappeared altogether, or there aren't any threats anymore. To me, this seems impossible, and thus our military forces must always be ready and vigilant. Readiness of military forces is itself a type of deterrent." Turning to Ayah 60 of Surah Anfal in the Holy Quran, Ayatollah Khamenei said that constant readiness is a divine commandment and a source of fear for the enemies of God and the nation. He said, "Threats will never disappear for good. Therefore, it is necessary to increase preparedness in all areas." The leader of the Islamic Revolution said that military preparedness would act as a deterrent against the enemies, calling for vigilance in the face of those plotting behind the scenes and describing this as absolutely essential. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We must not preoccupy ourselves with small enemies who sometimes speak and act in such a way as to draw our attention." The leader added, "We should not preoccupy ourselves with such things. Rather, we should focus on the main plotters acting behind the scenes." Referring to the warmongering of the wicked global powers worldwide, he said that wherever arrogant powers find something of interest to them, they covertly create conflict. He pointedly added, "For example, there is a war going on in Ukraine today. But who is responsible for initiating this war? Who has designed and programmed this war in Ukraine? In Syria, Libya, Sudan, and elsewhere, wars have broken out, and there are those who are behind these wars. They have designed and fueled these wars. But who are they? We call them the arrogant global powers. That's who they are, the arrogant global powers. They are aggressive and they start wars and conflicts in order to benefit from these conflicts." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader pointed out that the commanders of the armed forces must focus carefully on the enemy's long-term plans. In this regard, he said, "It is necessary and reasonable to focus on the enemy's plans for the next 5 years to 10 years, but their medium and long-term plans should also be watched and observed." Alluding to the two wars that the United States launched on Iran's eastern and western borders 2 decades ago, he said that these wars were motivated by American interests, but their ultimate goal was Iran. However, due to the Islamic Revolution's strong stamina, the Americans failed in their adventures and could not reach their ultimate goal. Pointing to these realities, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Despite all of its calculations and seemingly strong appearance and military might, the enemy can be defeated." The leader pointedly added, "The enemy sometimes makes miscalculations, and they can certainly be defeated. We must always bear this in mind." Referring to the present situation that the Zionist regime of Israel finds itself in as another example of these defeats, the leader said that the Zionist regime's anti-Palestinian operations during the month of Ramadan in last year was not met with a backlash in the world, but this year, even in the United States and England, demonstrations were held against the Israeli regime and the crimes it has committed in the occupied Palestinian lands. He said that it is essential to be on constant vigilance and the same belief that the enemy is not invincible. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed, "At no time should we let our guard down in the face of an enemy which resorts to deception and treachery." the leader of the Islamic Revolution wrapped up his speech by encouraging the intellectual centres of the Iranian armed forces to constantly plan and develop innovative strategies and robust, rational and effective policies.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Is going through an unprecedented internal crisis, which has reached the point where the Israeli entity's president, Isaac Herzog, warned that it might cause a civil war, which would leave no trace of the Israeli occupation entity. On one side of the barricade, the government coalition headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, made up of the Likud party and religious parties from Haredi and nationalist Zionists, is lurking in opposition to opponents from parties that are predominantly secular, but nonetheless Zionists, in a quarrel with Netanyahu. In the details of the dispute, the Israeli government submitted 6 days after its formation, that is on the 4th of last January, draft laws to introduce amendments to the Israeli judicial system. These draft amendments were accompanied by wide opposition from the political arc in Israel, who are outside the coalition, as well as from former officials, elites and experts who were joined by most of the Zionist media. All of them led a protest movement that was expressed in periodic sit-ins and demonstrations in Tel Aviv and other cities, protesting the government amendments, which they described as a coup against the system of government and democracy. Yeah, I know it's funny. A colonial occupation that thinks of itself as a democracy. Anyhow, with the approval of the amendments approaching in the Knesset with a simple majority held by the government, the protests expanded and grew, while the list of those who rejected the amendments became longer, and they were joined by members of the Knesset from the Likud, led by Minister of Security Yoav Gallant, who was later dismissed due to his opposition. But what are these modifications? Do they deserve all these protests against them or all that adherence to them in return by Netanyahu's coalition to the extent that it causes a political and social clash and threatens to dismantle institutions, including the occupation's army? The amendments aim to limit the power of the judiciary by preventing it from invalidating laws enacted by the Knesset, on the background of the latter's opposition to basic laws or legal principles that the Israeli Supreme Court has intended to follow to invalidate certain projects, due to considerations most of which are based on human rights, freedom of expression, the reasonable use of power, discrimination, and so on. The amendments also aim to change the method of selecting and appointing judges, primarily Supreme Court judges, by changing the composition of the appointment committee members, provided that the ruling coalition has the final say in selection. That would make Netanyahu's day, given the many corruption cases against him. In fact, the attempt to introduce the above-mentioned amendments, as well as the attempt to prevent them, is an expression of the reality of a sharp division within the Israeli community of very different societies. But does this division really portend a civil war? We hope for the best. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli internal battle appears to be at its most intense amid a gradual escalation by the opposition against the government of Benjamin Netanyahu and the latter's increasing tendencies to suppress its opponents. While it is on the path of bringing about radical changes in the system of government that would move Israel from one bank to the other. And while it appears, according to the logical calculations of the premises and results, that the Zionist entity is on the verge of a state of civil strife, or in this case, an illegal colonial settler strife. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Amal. Now, it's truly interesting what's going on inside of the Zionist entity, and we have seen opinion polls that show that more than half of those who voted for Benjamin Netanyahu are now against him, especially after they opposed the government's judicial reform or plan to do judicial reform, which the ruling coalition is still insisting on completing, despite the fact that they agreed to pause it right now, but they still want to see it happen. Can you explain what the actual reason behind this heightening tension is?
Yes, hi, Dr. Manro. Thanks for having me again. Well, Netanyahu's eagerness to reform or overhaul the judiciary system is, first of all, to save his neck from several charges of misdemeanors he's facing. He doesn't want to face the fate of Olmert and Deri, who both had to serve jail time, of similar charges, of course. Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, on the other side, who represent the extremist Zionist religious parties, want to have a free hand, not only on in oppressing the Palestinian people and stealing what's left of their lands, building more settlements and suppressing the political prisoners' movement to the extent that they are calling now for executions of prisoners, without any considerations to the international law or international organizations. They, in addition to this, they also want to impose their extremist religious way of life on the rest of the colonial society, such as the liberals and seculars and left Zionists. So both sides They want a reform so that they can have a free hand. Even though they delayed the execution of these reforms since they have the majority, if they're going to have to face the same fate because the opposition is insisting on stopping Netanyahu, and now discussions are to square one. They want to make a constitution. Having to do a constitution or writing a constitution for after 75 years of colonial Israel is something that's going to take a long time. So I don't think that this will happen. Actually, after the resignation of firing the defense minister from his post, this whole thing has elapsed because people know that the army that once used to unite the society, the whole society, left and right, now is in danger.
This weakening of societal cohesion has reached a stage where it can no longer be hidden or ignored. And the seriousness of all of this is about the disintegration of the institutions and mainly the occupation army, especially after Ben-Gvir was adamant on creating a new militia, which he calls the National Guard, which most probably he will be using against whoever is his opponent. So how would such a political strife affect the army?
Well, the army is facing a problem already. They're facing a problem on several levels, ideological, structural, and theological problems. As we know, the government, years ago, the government has privatized the services in the army, and this privatization has affected the ideology of the army. And the structure of it. Now the rabbis have hand in the army. They are affecting, you know, the chain of order, the military chain of order within the army. So the soldiers are split or divided between the two sections, the professional military army and the rabbis. And this affects the structure, the main structure, and the ideology of the army. There is no willingness now to fight. There is no goal for the army to fight. They are scattered in different political parties and political
ideologies. Doesn't this give
ideologies.
A momentum for the Palestinian resistance? I mean, amongst all of what's happening, the Israelis are still killing on a daily basis Palestinians, especially in the West Bank and in Al-Quds, for example, like this morning, the occupied Al-Quds. But doesn't that actually, this kind of disintegration, doesn't it give a momentum for the Palestinian resistance to increase its operations?
Well, it does. Just one more thing about Ben-Gvir and his national guards or national militia. We have, you know, to enlighten the viewers that this militia is already there. The settlers who are forming, who are going to be the body of this national guard, are
they're operating as a militia already. He just wants to organize and pay
them. I mean, they have the arms, they have everything in their hands, and we can see them on videos and on camera and in different media outlets. They are with machine guns, even women and little children. There are videos of little children training on these weapons. So they are equipped with weapons and equipped with goals. They have a bank of goals to follow, which is to make the lives of Palestinians more difficult for them, and in order to leave, in order to get away with their lives. As we see now, there are several locations of tensions between Palestinians and settlers, between Palestinians from one side, settlers and the army from the other side, like we witnessed in Hawara, like we see in Jenin. Just yesterday, there were several locations where there were confrontations, I mean, armed struggle confrontations with the Palestinians. So for us Palestinians, this is the moment actually to increase our unity, to increase our speech to the whole world, international organizations, human rights organizations, that this government is going on with its plans, which is their own and solely a plan, is to ethnically cleanse what's left from the Palestinians, from their lands, including 1948. Yesterday, there was a general strike called by the Arabs inside the occupied Palestine, 1948, in opposition to the killing, you know, the intentional killing of Dr. Muhammad al-Usaibi from al-Naqab. This action actually is being not only ordered, it's being taught as an ideology to the soldiers and to the settlers. And we've seen lots of video
and
that shows
next,
that
most probably, next most probably we will be seeing that so-called National Guard, which is AKA the militia of Ben-Gvir himself, also executing these plans upon the Palestinians. I want to thank you very much from the occupied West Bank, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for joining us to talk about the pressing issues inside the Zionist entity and how it is affecting the Palestinian natives as well. Now, please, I want you to stay with us, because next we will be talking about the tension that's now escalating between Iran and Azerbaijan.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
The high level of relations between Azerbaijan and Israel during the mutual visits between officials of the two sides in recent days, and Tel Aviv's announcement that it is about to build a strategic alliance with Baku directed against Iran threatens the society and rang all the alarm bells inside of Tehran, especially since Baku did not deny what the Israeli foreign minister said about cooperation and partnership against Iran. Instead of Baku responding to the Iranian request to provide clarifications regarding the Israeli statements about the alliance against it, Baku leveled accusations against Iran, which increased the level of tension in the relationship and made it clear that Ilham Aliyev is moving to conclude an alliance with Tel Aviv directed against the Islamic Republic. More details in the following report.
The roots of the rivalry between Tehran and Baku go back to the 19th century, where the Soviet Union cut off Azerbaijan from Persia. And despite the independence of Azerbaijan after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, the relations of the two countries have fluctuated during the past decades between calm and escalation, against the background of the conflict over the Nagorno-Karabakh region on the one hand and the Azerbaijani-Israeli rapprochement on the other. After rounds of escalating tension and separatist groups within both countries playing on the chord of Azeri nationalism, the personal armed attack on the Azerbaijani embassy in Tehran last January set fire to the complex relations between the two countries. But what was published by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz last week concerning the growing relations between Baku and Tel Aviv at the expense of Tehran angered the Iranians. The Israeli entity's foreign minister Eli Cohen's claims about the agreement with the Azerbaijani foreign minister to, quote, form a united front against Iran, unquote, prompted Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani to up the ante against both Baku and Tel Aviv. Kanani commented on the Haaretz newspaper report by saying that Tehran's position on the Zionist entity is clear, and that his country's relations with the countries of the region come within this framework, adding that the Islamic Republic has explained its position to neighboring countries on Tel Aviv's destabilizing role in security and stability, and that Iran hopes that these countries will pay attention to regional interests and bilateral relations with Iran. Kanani emphasized the inseparable historical and religious ties between the Iranian and Azerbaijani peoples, adding that the Islamic Republic of Iran has always sought to thwart the opponent's attempts to create a gap between the two neighboring countries, and that the Azerbaijani government is also expected to avoid the trap set by the enemy of Iranian-Azeri relations. Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen had held a meeting with Azerbaijani Minister Jehan Bayramov, who arrived in Israel to inaugurate his country's embassy in Tel Aviv. After the meeting, Cohen said, Israel and Azerbaijan must work together to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear capability. Adding, according to the Zionist Khan channel, I agreed with the Azerbaijani Foreign Minister to form a united front against Iran. Instead of Baku responding to the Iranian request to provide clarifications regarding the Israeli statements about the alliance against it, the former raised accusations against Iran, which increased the level of tension in the relationship and made it clear that Ilham Aliyev seems keen on finalizing an alliance with Tel Aviv directed against Iran. Iran views with concern Israel's positioning on its borders within the neighboring Republic of Azerbaijan, especially since Tel Aviv has previously used Azerbaijani lands to carry out security operations inside Iran, including the assassination of Iranian scientists. The presence of Israel in Azerbaijan on the Iranian borders inside the South Caucasus region represents a threat to Iranian national security in a vital and important region that Iran has sought over decades to contribute to its stability and keep it away from conflicts.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, political commentator and deputy mayor of Tehran for international affairs. I want to thank you immensely, Dr. Hamid, for being with us now. Iran has sent a strongly worded message of protest to Azerbaijan over the hostile campaign launched by the Azeri media against Tehran following the statements of the Israeli foreign minister regarding the agreement with Azerbaijan, with the foreign minister of Azerbaijan on, quote, forming a united front against Iran, unquote. Is this a surprising stand from Baku against Tehran now?
Thank you very much for having me.
the relationship between Azerbaijan and the Zionist regime is not nothing new, but it is being revealed more and more these days. It has been for decades that the Israelis have been trying to actually set their foot there and try to use that land against Iran for espionage. And such is the one of the examples in, was in your report about the espionage that they had in the past. But the point is that these days the relationship between the between Baku and the Zionist regime is more than before, and they are now openly and overtly talking about a common enemy, and they are actually being used by the Zionists to stand against Iran. So the thing is that the Azerbaijani government now thinks that Iran is weakened and Israelis are strong enough to support them. And there is another player, that is Turkey. Turkey also is also trying to use Azerbaijan, use this land to change the geopolitics of the region. And that's the point that they are trying to do that. So the fact that the Azeris, Azerbaijani people, and the government, I mean, have been used by the Israelis is nothing new. But this level, to this extent, it is new and would be actually very, let's say, risky for the...
This is actually what makes things very interesting here, Dr. Hamid, because, I mean, the relationship between Iran and Azerbaijan since the beginning of this year has been escalating in tension after what happened in Tehran against the... which was stated after the investigation that it was actually a personal attack and not an actual attack against anyone. It was a family attack against the embassy of Azerbaijan. But the two sides have never really been very friendly. I'm talking about the governments here. They did remain controlled over the decades. But now, what makes Azerbaijan keen on increasing hostilities in the region at the expense of its own national security when the entire West Asian region is changing because of the world order is changing?
The miscalculation is the main answer. The same miscalculation that Turkey has done and many other countries that the so-called Abrahamic Accord countries did the same miscalculation, and it is now for Azerbaijan. The same miscalculation that the Turkey did. They think proudly that they have acquired some power, and they have forgotten that the power needs to be something domestic and true and real, and needs something internal to be something that you can actually rely upon. That that's what Iran has. That's the sort of power that Iran has in the region. It has many difficulties, it has economic problems, such things, but anyway, the power is so internal and so rooted in the country and its people that it cannot be changed, and it has its power in the region. So Azerbaijan is thinking that by aligning with Israelis and Turkey, they can be a power and they can change the geopolitics of the region, and they can connect that part of the country which is separated from the mainland to their own, and by that changing the everything there in Armenia. And Turkey is using them to open a corridor from its land up to China through the Caspian Sea, by using this land, the land of Azerbaijan. And that is the problem. Mm-hmm. They think that the Israelis would support them, Turkey would support them, and maybe Western countries would support them. And by that, they are risking this. And they cannot remember that many countries have actually relied upon Westerners, upon Israelis, the Zionist regime, and they never actually...
Yep, but the issue here is that the Republic of Azerbaijan has already used Israeli-made weapons in the war against the Armenians, and they won, actually, the war against Armenia because of that weapons and because of also the help of Turkey. But if the weapons are already there and Iran knows of the growing influence of Iran inside Baku itself, what prevents Iran from a defensive strategy against Baku?
Because Iran is actually... always has been pursuing a lessening of tension between the neighbors, and it needs less tension in the region. So it is not pursuing a war or some military campaign against a neighboring country. I would like to add to your sentence that, yes, Azerbaijan did win that war with the help of the Turkey and with the help of the Israeli armies and the weapons, let's say. But the point is that there was another point to the story, that Iran did not intervene in that incident, and to some extent it put its support behind Azerbaijan. If Iran wanted to intervene, there would for sure be another conclusion to the that war, and the outcome would be totally different. And Iran is very clear in that regard, that if the geopolitics of the region and the borders are going to be changed, either at its border or a little further in other parts, so that Iran cannot have its border clearly with Armenia, then that would change the story, and Iran would intervene militarily, and it's not something that Iran would stand. So they are risking to check to see how far Iran would go, and Iran is clear on that. Yes, if it would result in and demand Iran to actually militarily, Iran would do that. Mm-hmm. Iran would do that just in that case. But before that, it's trying to, solve it diplomatically with a negotiation and with the intervention of the others in order to avoid another war in this already volatile region that we are living in West Asia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, political commentator and deputy mayor of Tehran for international affairs, for joining us to talk about this new heightening of tension between Iran and its neighboring country in Azerbaijan. Thank you very much for being with us. Ladies and gents, I want to thank you. See you again next week, inshallah, on the Mideast Stream.
The Limelight.
The U.S. state of Oregon, which is Democrat-controlled, could pass a new bill that could criminalize environmental protest as terrorism. This state could become the 20th in the U.S. to enact a so-called critical infrastructure law. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, a bill that could stifle environmental protest has emerged in an unlikely place: the Democrat-controlled Oregon State Legislature. Lawmakers in the Beaver State are considering a bill that could make disruption of services provided by so-called critical infrastructure, which includes roads, pipelines, electrical substations, and some oil and gas infrastructure, a felony punishable by up to 10 years in prison and $250,000 in fines. The bill labels such activity domestic terrorism. The bill's sponsor, Democratic State Representative Paul Evans, and other proponents argue that the legislation is necessary to adequately punish extremists who may seek to damage facilities that provide essential public services. The bill appears to be a direct response to the 2022 racial justice protests that turned violent in Portland and the breach of the state capitol in Salem by far-right protesters the same year. A recent report by the Oregon Secretary of State claims that the state has experienced one of the highest rates of domestic violent extremism in the country, and that critical infrastructure continues to be a high-risk target. What happens when someone decides that for a fun evening they're going to go out and destroy an electrical substation that cripples the community for a day, a week? Yvonne said during a committee hearing, adding, "The fact is, we have some gaps in the way in which we approach those sorts of crimes." But existing state laws already make trespassing and property damage criminal offenses. And environmental and civil liberties advocates are concerned that decreasing disruption of services to be domestic terrorism could result in charges for nonviolent protesters who may block a road, bridge, or oil and gas site during a protest. He said, "That's the stuff that could happen at ordinary protest." Nick Caleb, an attorney with